You're listening to the North Canton Chapel Podcast. Thank you for joining us today. The North Canton Chapel exists to make much of Jesus every day to everyone. It's our prayer that this podcast will equip you to do just that. We believe that there's nothing like the church united together in gospel community. We'd love if you'd stop in and say hello in person if you're in our neighborhood. Our gathering times are at 9 and 10:30 a.m. Thank you again for joining us today. Let's listen in.
Welcome. Glad you guys are here with us today. Let's start just with a statement that I just want to encourage you to think about. And I'm not going to ask you whether or not you believe it yet or not, but I just want to throw it out there and invite you to consider it. Most human behavior is driven by what we believe about God. Most human behavior is driven by what we believe about God. Here's what I mean. If I really believed that God was a gracious father treating me with kindness and love, if I really believed that, maybe I wouldn't work so hard to prove myself all the time or spend so much time trying to impress people. If we really believe that God was sovereign, right, directing the universe, if we really believe that, maybe we wouldn't worry so much about the future, or we could sleep a little better at night. If we really believe that God was creator, really created you as an individual creation from his hand, maybe we could rest knowing that we are the creation of a personal God and we wouldn't be so quickly swept up into shame and self-doubt. If we really believe that God was satisfying, maybe we wouldn't look for satisfaction in 1,001 different places. We could rest in him. Most of human behavior is driven by what we believe about God. This is the task of all true theology, and the joy, I think, of every Christian is to close the gap between what we believe about God and how we behave or live in the world. Don't you want a really clear picture of God? Like who he is, what he's like, what he's done for you, and maybe even why he wants what he wants for you. If we could just get that in our heads and in our hearts, how much different would our life actually be? So this morning we're in our third week of our teaching series called Theology, How It Works. This is week 3 of 7. And we started with a not so quick intro because it's me. And then last week we were looking at the value of God's word in the Bible. And so this morning we're just going to take a real quick look at who God is, what he's like, and what he's done. There's lots of ways we could approach this, but I want to anchor our time together in one text. We're going to be in Acts chapter 17. And so if you've got a Bible, turn there, flip there, scroll there. Acts chapter 17 is where a bold and burdened preacher meets a curious crowd. And so here's where we're going. This morning is going to be in two halves, really. We're going to spend the first 15 minutes in Acts chapter 17 walking through this text like we normally do. We're going to draw out some conclusions about who God is. Then we're going to take that picture and we're going to hold it up against 9 different world religions. And we're going to ask, well, how is the God of the Bible any different than all these other gods or any other worldviews? So we've got a lot of hay to bale, and we'll get to it right now. Acts chapter 17. Here's the scene. Acts chapter 17, verse 16. Now, while Paul was waiting for them at Athens, his spirit was provoked within him as he saw that the city was full of idols. We're catching this like right midstream. You're jumping right in the middle of a story. Well, who is Paul waiting for? He's waiting for his two best friends, Timothy and Silas. These are two guys that Paul traveled with, he did ministry with, and he even suffered with. And he gets to Athens before they do. We get the sense that he's reluctant to start any ministry movement without them. But Paul's not just twiddling his thumbs, sipping lattes at the Athenian Starbucks. When he gets into town, his spirit is provoked. Did you catch that in the text? His heart is provoked within him. That's a heartbreakingly beautiful word in Greek that means not a sudden loss of temper, but a continuous, unsettled reaction. I wonder how your heart feels when you look at our world. sudden flash of anger? Or is there something in you that may resonate with how Paul's feeling, a continuous unsettled action? Well, why? This isn't an explosive flash. This is a slow burn. And what causes this inner burning? He sees that the city is full of idols. And so as the slow burn of burden starts to heat up inside Paul, he can't help himself. Verse 17. So he reasoned in the synagogue with the Jews and the devout persons, and in the marketplace every day with those who happened to be there. Some of the Epicurean and Stoic philosophers also conversed with him, and some said, "What does this babbler wish to say?" Others said, "Well, he seems to be a preacher of foreign divinities because he was preaching Jesus and the resurrection." They took him and brought him to the Areopagus. We'll come back to that in just a minute, saying, "We want to know this teaching that you're presenting. Can we know it? For you bring some strange things to our ears. We wish to know what these things mean." Now, the Athenians and the foreigners who lived there would spend their time in nothing except telling and hearing something new. So let's repaint this scene a little bit. Paul ping-pongs around to three different places, three different audiences. First, he goes to the synagogue and he reasons with the Jews, the devout people there. Then he goes to the marketplace where he seems like he talks with the philosopher types. Last, he heads to the Areopagus, which we'll come back to. Seems like he's prepping a speech for the locals. And as our imagination follows Paul down the stone-lined streets, we kind of get a little bit of a picture of what the religious climate of first century Athens was like. We can tell that they're curious, okay. We can tell that they're open to new ideas, but they also seem suspicious. That word babbler in verse 18, isn't that a great word? What's this babbler talking about? Somebody emailed me that the other day and said, no, I'm just joking. What is this babbler talking about? It's a great word. Originally, that word babbler was used in this culture to mean birds that come around and pick up garbage out of the street. And it came to be used as someone who comes and picks up something that's not theirs so they can regurgitate it. And they're going, is that what this guy's about? Is Paul just like talking for talking's sake, or does he actually have something substantive to say? Paul, don't parrot back what you heard from your news channel of choice. I don't care if you're Fox News or CNN. We don't care. Tell us what you learned in Sunday school. Open up yourself. Tell us what you believe. Quick summary, bring the real. What a wonderful gospel insight for us, isn't it? The world, now as then, deserves real answers from real people who've really wrestled through real problems. Don't just spit it back. So Paul steps up to this place called the Areopagus. Now, we don't have a cultural corollary for the Areopagus in our world, but the best way to think about it is to think about it like the platform of a TED Talk with like the social appeal of like a local coffee shop with the viral nature of like YouTube Live. If you have something to say to this culture, this is where you go to say it. So what's Paul say? And here's why I chose this text as our anchor text for this morning. We live in an Acts 17 world, curious, open, and suspicious, and we have to bring the real. And so what Paul says in these verses and how he says it is absolutely wonderful. Take a look in verse 22. So Paul, standing in the midst of the Areopagus, said, "Men of Athens, I perceive that in every way you are very religious. For as I passed along and observed the objects of your worship, I found also an altar with this inscription, 'To the unknown God.' What therefore you worship as unknown, this I proclaim to you." Now, you guys know I love a good sermon intro. And this is a really good sermon intro because he tells his story. He says, "Hey, I was waiting. I was waiting for Silas and Timothy. And as I was waiting, I was walking. And as I was walking, I was watching. And as I was watching, I was breaking. And as I was breaking, I was burning." Like, he sees statues, marble cast and chiseled, each one with their own name underneath them. Some of which he recognized, some he didn't. Some of which were local, some of which were tied to the Roman Empire. And then he saw one statue that on the bottom said, "Agnostotheo, to an unknown God." Archaeologists have actually uncovered statues with this inscription in Athens. What's that about? To an unknown God. What are they trying to do? The Athenians were trying to make sure that they had all their bases covered. You ever seen this sticker? That's, you've seen this before. Okay, this is pluralism. Pluralism is the desire to form a culture conducive to the existence of multiple religions. This is Athens. We've got this and this and this and this and this. But just in case we're missing something, here's a statue that says to an unknown God, like make up your own. There, bases covered. And then Paul, ever the missionary, grabs that idea as his theological starting point. He says, what you worship is unknown, this I proclaim to you. Verse 24. Now watch where he goes. The God who made the world and everything in it, being Lord of heaven and earth, does not live in temples made by man, nor is he served by human hands as if he needed anything. Since he himself gives to all mankind life and breath and everything. And he made from one man every nation of mankind to live on the face of the earth, having determined allotted periods and the boundaries of their dwelling places, that they should seek God and perhaps feel their way toward him and find him. Yet, he's actually not far from each one of us. What a beautiful verse that is. For, and then he quotes Athenian poetry. He says, in him we live and move and have our being. And some of your own poets have said, for we indeed are his offspring. So Paul starts with the creation narrative. This is where his sermon starts. There is a God, one God, and he created us. He's sovereign, determining the course of our lives. He invites us to seek him, and I love that word, to feel our way toward him. Isn't that great? But the cool thing, Athenians, is he's actually not far from you. The thumbprint of his work is all around you. And it's even better, the thumbprint of his work is in you. And Paul lets their imaginations drift for a little bit, and then he grabs the wheel hard, and he makes a beeline for the gospel. Verse 29, being then God's offspring, we ought not to think that divine being is like gold or silver or stone or an image formed by the art or the imagination of man. This is a wonderful play on words here. I want us to really see what he's saying. Paul's going, look, if there is a God, and for the moment you seem at least willing to entertain the idea that God might exist. So if you're thinking about that, it would make sense that if there was a God worthy of worship, he would not be a God that we have created. He would be outside of us, bigger than us, beyond us, before us. I mean, if I can make him, he's not much of a God. Now, that's deceptively deep theology because people today worship gods that they've made all the time. Their jobs, their kids, their 401ks, their whatever. The question then, well, okay, Paul, well, what should we do with all these gods? Great question. Glad you asked. Verse 30. Times of ignorance, God overlooked. But now he commands all people everywhere to repent. Okay, so there were times when people didn't see everything that your God was about, Paul, okay? Times of ignorance. And in those times, he was kind of holding back. And now you're saying that he's recently revealed something that should draw us to repentance. Why? Because, verse 31, he has fixed a day on which he will judge the world. Whoa. Downshift much, Paul? That's a big change. There's a day coming when this God that you're telling us about is going to come judge the world. All this is going to come to a head. A day coming where we can't just speculate, cogitate, or pontificate. We can't just sit around and talk anymore. We're actually going to have to land somewhere. But everybody kind of gets in, right, Paul? You said we're all his offspring. So like, judge, nah, everybody's kind of in, right? He will judge the world in righteousness. Oh, okay. Righteousness. That's the standard. Well, now we're getting a little nervous, Paul. Oh, you're nervous now, he says. Let me push this further because there's one thing more. He will judge the world in righteousness by a man whom he has appointed, and of this he has given assurance to all by raising him from the dead. What a masterful sermon from Paul. Because they're all there sitting there thinking, hold up, okay, wait, let's put this together. We're all philosopher types, but sometimes we're a little bit slow. Give us a minute to think this out, Paul, because this sounds pretty heavy. First off, you're saying there's one God. This God is high and holy, he's above us, and he's also with us somehow. That's strange, we've not heard that before. He doesn't need us, but he invites us to seek him. He wants us to seek him because he's actually seeking us. And this God is kind enough to overlook our faults. He's just shown us something that should cause me to own my sin and turn from my sin because he's coming to judge in righteousness. And the way we escape that judgment is through someone who just rose from the dead. Is that pretty much it, Paul? And Paul's going, yes. Hey, didn't we just hear about a guy, like a Jewish rabbi? What was his name? That guy that rose from the dead. What was his name again? Nope, that wasn't it. What was that guy's name? Oh, it was Jesus of Nazareth. That's one of the ones, the carpenter's son. You don't really think that's true, do you? You don't really think he rose from the dead. I mean, if that's true, I need to get to know him and I need to make sure he knows me. When he comes back in judgment one day, and you don't know when that's gonna be, Paul, okay, I need to make sure that I have received whatever he wants to give me. But not only me, I need my wife and my kids and my neighbors. Paul, if what you're saying is true, this is a really big deal. Either Jesus answers every question I've ever had, either he's the meaning of life and all purpose, or he isn't worth a second thought. Either he's everything or he's nothing. I either serve him my whole life or I ignore him my own life. What do we got to do, Paul? Now, when they heard of the resurrection of the dead, verse 32, some mocked and others said, "We will hear from you again about this." So Paul went out from their midst. Some men joined him and believed, among whom also were Dionysus the Areopagite, and a woman named Damaris, and others with them. Now, we're in 2024, and you don't have Epicurean and Stoic philosophers hanging out at home. Maybe you do, I doubt it. We're gonna take a look at how the message of the gospel differs from 9 major world religions and worldviews. But before we get there, what can we take from this text? There is a ton of conclusions. I only wanna name one. And here it is. The gospel is always relevant. The gospel is always relevant. I hear this comment all the time. I hear it in conversations. I even hear it in prayers. I hear it wandering around. I hear it in passing conversations. And the comment or a variation of it goes something like this. Oh, gosh, our world is going to hell in a handbasket. Gosh, things are so bad. It's never been this bad before. It just gets worse and worse and worse. Man, like our country and our culture, I don't know how this is all gonna end up. I don't know where this is gonna go. And those comments are usually accompanied by a heavy sigh and a hanging head. I'm gonna be honest. Those comments sadden me. And they sadden me because they represent a perspective of the gospel that seems to me to be very anemic and very thin and very weak and no longer capable of giving hope that changes lives and changes cultures. Stepping up to the platform of pluralism, Paul preached the gospel of a risen Christ. Why? Because there will never be a time when Jesus is not alive. That is a big deal. We live in an Acts 17 world, and it's pluralistic, and it's relativistic, and it's postmodern, and it's dark. And I go, okay, Jesus still saves. He's still risen. He's still sovereign. He's still working. He's still on the throne. He still gives purpose. He still cancels hell. He still guarantees heaven. The gospel is always relevant. Now, I said a few minutes ago that all of human behavior, at least most of human behavior, is driven by what we believe about God or how we see God. And so for the next 20 minutes or so, I think it might be helpful to take Acts 17 and overlay it on our 2024 world. So with that gospel truth under our feet, I want to take a look at nine major world religions and almost unbearably quickly talk about how the hope that Jesus offers is fundamentally different, more compelling, and ultimately more satisfying. I'm doing the math. That's like maybe a minute and a half for each. So pray for me and I will watch the clock. One quick point though before we get to it. I want to pull off a bit just to frame it. Every world religion has to answer at least five basic questions, and here they are. Number one, what's wrong with the world? Number two, how can the wrong be made right? Number three, what's my role in that making right of the world? Like, what do I have to do? What's my part to play? Number four, if there is a God, if God exists, what's his role? What has he done? Okay, and then if you're taking a picture of the slide, here's the fifth one. It's so weird. I just saw like a bunch of phones come out. It's really trippy. Number five, where does hope ultimately lie? Like, how can I know that things are going to turn out all right in the end? If you are a major world religion, you've got to ask these questions. And then you have to answer them in a way that's compelling. Quick little teaser. So leave this slide up for just a little bit, guys. Quick teaser. Later this fall, we're going to do a teaching series called What's the Difference? Where we're going to do a more expanded look into what we're going to do now. This is just the cliff notes this morning. So if that's interesting for you, sit tight to the fall or buy me a cup of coffee between now and then, and we can go a little deeper. Now, nine world religions, like 18 minutes left. So this is going to be quick, but I think it'll be helpful. You ready? Off we go. If you start with the question, does God exist? You've got two options, yes or no. On one side, you've got atheism, that's the no. On the other side, you've got theism. Okay, that's the yes. And we're gonna follow the path to the right first, okay? I said this morning when we were going over the slides, I said, let's follow atheism for a little while. And I was like, wait, no, don't take that out of context. Nobody tweet that, please, we're not. So atheism, if you look inside atheism, you've got three different options in here. I'm gonna walk through each one of these quickly so you can know a little bit more about what they mean and how the gospel differs. First off, we're gonna start with what we would call atheism proper. Atheism is not just non-belief. Okay, that's not just like, well, I don't know, I'm not really religious. Or atheism is not just passive, like, well, I've never thought about God. Atheism is not the absence of belief, like, well, I just don't believe anything. Atheism, true atheism, is the active belief that there is no God. This is an active denial. Like, this is all made up. Church is just one giant circus. Your generosity is funding lies. This is a hoax. Everyone's just messing with you. Now, I cannot, in the next 45 seconds, give you a fully formed answer for atheism. I'm not going to try. The whole thing kind of becomes a game of one-upsmanship, trying to prove the existence of God, which empirically and rationally, you can't do 100%. That's where faith comes in. Both the theist and the atheist require faith. We didn't talk about that enough. But having defined what atheism is, I wanna give you this from a theologian that I love called Cornelius Van Til. With a name like Cornelius Van Til, you're either gonna be a theologian or a pharmacist. Like, that's just... If you're a pharmacist, God bless you. Here's what he says. Just listen to this. I love this. Arguing about God's existence, I hold, is like arguing about air. You can affirm that air exists, and I can affirm that it does not. But even as we debate the point, we are breathing air the whole time. The only proof for the existence of God is that without God, you couldn't prove anything. I love that, and we have to leave that there for now. But that's what atheism is, the active denial of the existence of God. Swinging to the other side, we're going to go to agnosticism, okay? Agnosticism is part of this. Atheism says there is no God. Agnosticism says, I don't know, maybe there is, maybe there isn't. I don't know. I don't think you can know. For someone to be an agnostic, they want one thing, certainty, 100% certainty. And here's the question. Can you trust something without 100% certainty? Think about that. Can you trust something that you're not 100% certain of? Absolutely. You do it every day. You're doing it right now and you don't even know it. Every time you get in a car, You trust that it's going to run, and so you turn the key. There's an element of faith in that. Every time you cross a street, you trust that a bus isn't going to come out of nowhere to run you over, and so you step out. Every time you sit in a chair, like you're doing right now, you are trusting that that chair is going to hold you. You didn't do a thorough examination before you sat down, but sat down you did. You're not 100% certain of any of those things. As soon as you hit the end of your driveway, your car could explode. Sorry. As soon as you step out into the street, a bus could come out of nowhere. Right now, the chair that you're sitting on could collapse. That would really be awkward if that happened. Here's my point, though. The lack of certainty doesn't prevent you from turning the key, stepping out, or sitting down. Here's the good news of the gospel. God doesn't want you to wander around in uncertainty. Luke was a doctor. He's a medical man. Thorough researcher. And Luke wrote this at the start of his gospel. This is Luke 1. He said, "It seemed good to me also, having followed all these things," meaning like I want Jesus and the disciples and this whole thing, "I followed it closely for some time, to write an orderly account for you, most excellent Theophilus," this is the benefactor who's paying for his work, "that you may have certainty concerning the things that you have been taught." In his own words, the point is, if you're curious about Jesus, start here. This was actually written by objective people who were very interested in Jesus, not proving a point or starting a religion necessarily. They just saw Jesus and they wanted to write about it. Going back to our tree here, you've got atheism, then you've got agnosticism, and in the middle, you've got secular humanism, quickly. Where agnosticism is comfortable with a question mark, like, I don't know, maybe. Secular humanism is an exclamation point and says, no, it's us. We're it. Two words, secular humanism. Secular meaning we don't have need for God. The second word explains the reason why. Humanism, we've got us. We're going to do this ourselves. Actual words from the Humanist Manifesto says, "No God will save us. We must save ourselves." My quick reaction to that is, saving the world is too heavy of a burden for you to bear. The good news of the gospel is that you don't have to bear the weight of saving the world or yourself. When Jesus says, "Come to me, all you who are tired and bogged down by the weight of the world, and I will rest you," that's more than a kind offer of him offering to carry the groceries or to give us a nap. Jesus is naming something there that's implicit in the human struggle. Exhaustion, restlessness, the constant striving and chasing but never reaching. The gospel is good news that by trusting Jesus to fix what's broken, we can actually be truer humans. So, if not atheism, let's back up and go over to theism a little bit. We're going to take two routes here. We're going to look at polytheism, which is many gods, and then we're going to look at monotheism. Polytheism, here's the first one we're going to take a look at. Buddhism. Buddhism is the one on the far left up there. It's really half religion, half philosophy. And although it's an Eastern religion, it's rising in popularity in the West. And I think I know why. Buddhism rests on what's called the Four Noble Truths. And here they are. Let's hit them really quick. First truth is life is marked by pain and suffering. That's where we start. Life is marked by pain and suffering. Second truth is that pain is caused by desire. I want something. And because I don't have it, I don't get it. Ugh. Third truth, the way out of pain is to let go or deaden your desire. Fourth, the way to do that is by following the teachings of Buddha, which is symbolized by the eightfold path, that eight-spoked wheel up there. Now, here's the thing about Buddhism and those four truths. It's 25% right. The first noble truth is dead on. Life is marked by pain and suffering. Go read Ecclesiastes. Go read Job. Gosh, just watch the news. But here's where the gospel is so very different from Buddhism. John 14:1, Jesus says this. He says, "Let not your heart be troubled. Believe in God, believe also in me." Leave that up there for a little bit. What's Jesus saying? Yeah, Suffering's gonna happen. When it happens, don't deaden your desire, deepen your desire. The context of John 14 is horrific. Jesus has just said, one of you is gonna deny me, one of you is gonna betray me, the world is gonna hate you, oh, and I'm leaving. And then he has the audacity to say that. Don't worry about it. If you trust in God, trust in me. How can he say that? This is the good news of the gospel. Jesus locates the solution to life's inevitable pain, not in denying or deadening our desire, but by deepening our desire and rooting ourselves in relationship with him. Don't deaden your desire, deepen it. Moving on, Hinduism. Hinduism, we're gonna slide this way. Hinduism, another Eastern religion that rises and falls on reincarnation and karma. Karma being more than just a Taylor Swift song. Here's how this works. Karma, if I live a good life, if I do good things, if I am motivated by good intentions, then my soul will come back in another life. And if that happens over and over and over and over again, eventually I'll work my way out of this wheel called life and I'll reach nirvana. That's how karma works. Here's where the gospel is so different than karma. Karma rests on my work. Grace rests on Christ's work. Karma says, you get what you deserve. Grace says, Jesus gets what you deserve. Karma says, I am the result of my own goodness. Grace says, you are the result of Christ's goodness for you. Karma says, what goes around comes around. Grace says, what goes around gets interrupted by a God who loves you. And so instead of sin hitting you, Jesus takes the hit for you, shielding you, protecting you, giving you what you don't deserve, heaven, instead of what you do deserve, hell. That's grace. Completely different. 2 Corinthians 5:21 says this, one of my favorite verses. For our sake, he made him to be sin who knew no sin, that in him we might become the righteousness of God. Do you hear how anti-karma that is? Karma would be like, well, you do the crime, you pay the time. And that's not how grace works. Grace says, no, you don't have to live in fear. You can rest in hope, knowing that when your life is over, we're reunited with our Father, not because of what we've done, karma, but because of what Jesus has done, grace. Okay, that's Hinduism. Sliding further over to the little squiggly guy at the far end, this is pantheism. Okay, pantheism, this is a tricky one to pin down. Here's the basic idea. Everything that you see is part of God. The most famous pantheist of our time, here he is, Yoda. Here's what Yoda has to say, and I'm not doing an impression because it's terrible. I'm working on it, but maybe I'll get there one day. Here's what Yoda has to say. My ally is the Force, and a powerful ally it is. Life creates it, makes it grow. Its energy surrounds us and binds us. Luminous beings are we, not this crude matter. You must feel the Force around you, here, between you, me, the tree, the rock, everywhere. Now, I like camping, but that's kind of next level. The best way to contrast pantheism with the gospel is to insist that there is a distinction between the creation and the creator. Anne Voskamp, who's a writer that I really love, says this, seeing the natural world as divine is very different than seeing the divine God in all things. What's her point? Don't mistake the thumbprint for the thumb. Paul talks about this in Acts 14:17 when he says this, yet he did not leave himself without witness, for he did good by giving you rains from heaven and fruitful seasons, satisfying your heart with food and gladness. These are the things that are here that God left for us. Romans 1, for his invisible attributes, namely his eternal power, his divine nature, are clearly perceived ever since the creation of the world in the things that have been made. Meaning like you watch a thunderstorm, you go, holy smokes. So that we are without excuse. In other words, you think the thumbprint is beautiful. Wait till you see the one who made it. Now, zooming back, that's polytheism. Let's go over to the monotheism side quickly. There's basically four major monotheistic religions. Start with Judaism. When I was working on our sermon this week, Our daughter Hannah, who's so stinking smart, asked me, she goes, okay, Dad, so which one of these are we most like? And I gave her two answers. I said, well, the gospel is fundamentally different than everything else because it's the only worldview where there's grace. She was not happy with that, so she pushed me. She goes, really though? And I said, actually, Christianity is probably, in one sense, very similar to Judaism. Here's why. Those 36 books of the Old Testament that we talked about last week, Christians and Jews agree that all of that is the word of God. We see God as a sovereign creator who chose his people Israel, who sent his prophets, a promised Messiah who will restore all things. But here's where our paths diverge. Jews are still waiting for their Messiah. Christians believe that he has already come. And it's Jesus. It's him. He is the seed from Adam in Genesis who will crush the serpent's head. He's the sacrificial lamb prefigured in the Exodus. He's the lion of the tribe of Judah. He's the perfect king from David's line. He's the one who brings the new covenant by his blood on the cross, not as a replacement of the old covenant, but the fulfillment of it. That messianic thread that's woven through the Jewish scriptures points to Jesus of Nazareth. Now, I've got a slide on. We're actually going to talk about Islam quickly. If Judaism stops too soon, Islam continues too far. Let's go back to the monotheism slide for a bit. There you go. The Islamic faith is anchored in something called the Shahada, which goes like this. There is no God but Allah, which is Arabic for God, and Muhammad is his prophet or messenger. The first part affirms God's nature. He is one. Now, we would agree with that. But the second part affirms the means by which God offers guidance to his people. And that's where we would disagree. Christians and Muslims hold belief that there is one God. Where we disagree is how do we know what God wants for us? And a Muslim would say, well, yeah, you know Jesus, but ultimately Muhammad. Now, because of time's sake, I'm going to have to be unfairly quick. Last fall, we did a teaching series on race. And as part of that teaching series, a member of our church and a good friend of mine, Daryush Miraj, shared his story of coming out of an Islamic faith and trusting Christ alone. And so if you're curious about more of what that has to do and how that might look, I want to encourage you. ncchapel.com/sermons. Look for that. It was week 3. And reacquaint yourself with that story, because he can share this with much greater clarity than I can. But the fundamental difference is Christ. Who is he and what did he do? Last one for this morning, and then we're going to land the plane. I'm going to tell you what to do about all this. Deism, that's the one on the far right. Deism, D-E-I-S-M. Deism came out as a political philosophy in the upper class America of the late 18th century. And it's a really complicated, but it's likely that most of our founding fathers were actually deists. Deism says this: yes, there's one God. Yes, he's sovereign. And yes, Jesus taught good things. But God is too distant to be known. He is impersonal. Forget about a relationship with him. Forget about supernatural things. Let's concern ourselves with building a moral society. Deism thinks about God like a divine watchmaker who made the universe and creation just like you'd make a watch. It's intricate and it's beautiful. You could even say it's a work of art. He wound it up, set it going, and then stepped back. Here's how this hits me. The deist God is a very cold God. And I have to wonder how many Christians operate and live like functional deists, where we go, well, yeah, I mean, God's there, like he's high and holy, but like, I don't really have a relationship with him. I go to church, I do my moral things, but as far as an actual relationship, Don't forget, guys, the gospel starts with, for God so loved the world that he gave. That's a relationship. If God is loving, that means relationship, and relationship means reaching out, not pulling back. Do you know how much God loves you? Not just created you or observes you or sees you, but loves you and wants to pursue you, delights in you, wants to be with you. The God of the Bible is ultimately a relational God. That's what Paul's talking about in Acts 17, is like he wants you to feel your way for him, knowing that he's feeling his way to you. All right, let's land the plane. Here's what I don't want you to do. I don't want you to imagine that theology is just this giant, like, Plinko game. where you just go like, tick, 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 and we like land here. I want to invite you to do something simpler but harder than that. And band, you guys can come on back out. Oh, Mike is here. That's great. Here's the question I want you to think about. In every heart, there is a throne. Who is on your throne? In every heart, there's a throne. Who is on your throne? Have you ever said, Jesus, I'm yours? Either for you, Jesus is the answer to life's pressing questions and he's everything to you, or he's nothing to you. Not worthy of a second thought. You should either serve him the rest of your life starting today, or you should ignore him the rest of your life starting today. And if I could really push it, don't come back next week if you don't want to learn more about Jesus, because that's where we're going next week. Having set all this in motion, we now need to say, okay, well, who is Jesus? What has he done? And why is what he's done so important? And so I want to invite you, if you would, we're going to stand and sing. We're going to sing a song that I think is just the perfect way to segue and to turn our thoughts from this high theology right into Christology next week. This is an old hymn. It's called How Marvelous. And basically it asks you to stand back and just go, gosh, how marvelous is it that God loves me, a sinner? How much must he love me to send his son to die for me?
Thank you for listening to this episode of the North Canton Chapel Podcast. If this ministry has blessed you in any way, please share this episode with your friends or spread the word on social media. If you subscribe and leave a 5-star review, it goes a long way to helping us make much of Jesus every day to everyone who hears these podcast episodes. You can also donate to this ministry at ncchapel.com/give. Thanks again for joining us. May you go out into your places and spaces, making much of Jesus every day to everyone.